there's a concept, and it's a psychological concept called post-traumatic growth. People can go through a traumatic experience and experience growth, and they built a model about around post-traumatic growth, which I'm deeply focused on. And it's these five areas of: you become personally stronger, you develop closer relationships, you have a greater appreciation for life around you, you see new possibilities around you, and there's some form of spiritual development. I can say from my experience that all five of those things have happened for me. Can you create or manufacture an experience without waiting for the trauma? I believe you can. And I believe you should.
Hi, welcome to the Growth Mixtape Podcast, and I'm your host, Bob Mathers. We have one rule here. We're going to chase our curiosity way outside our comfort zones. The more uncomfortable and awkward, the better. We're going to talk to people you've never heard of doing jobs you didn't know existed. We're going to hear human stories about the things that connect us, what we can learn from one another, and what we can take away to apply to our own lives. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs on a mixtape, you create something memorable and emotional. Today we talked to Greg Boyd, a father of three, a widower, a husband, and now an entrepreneur on a mission to help others live more intentional lives. Greg shares the deeply personal story of losing his wife, Allison, to brain cancer in 2020. And yes, it's a heartbreaking story. And yet, this isn't a sad conversation. We laughed more than we cried. Greg talks about the storybook life he had before all this happened, and how he's used his trauma to be a better dad, husband, friend, shit, just a better person. And he's channeling his experience to start a new company with his wife, Whitney, to help people get off autopilot and live the life they've always wanted. This is a conversation you will never forget. Whether you've had bad things happen to you or maybe you haven't yet, one thing is certain, they're coming. And that's not a dire view of the world, it's life, and nobody gets through it unscathed. When the unexpected happens, you're going to wake up. You're going to realize how short life is. You're going to want to make some changes to live the life you've always wanted. So the question is, why wait? Or better yet, as Greg says, what the fuck are you waiting for? Please enjoy Greg Boyd. All right, Greg Boyd, here we go. This is going to be amazing. I can't thank you enough for being here.
Bob, thank you for having me. This has been something I've been looking forward to.
So there's a couple of reasons why I'm really looking forward to this conversation. We've known each other for 10 years, and we're going to spend some time today talking about your wife, Allison, and her passing away in 2020, and what that was like, how it changed you, the work that you do. I've never heard the story. And so whether people know you and are tuning in to fill in the gaps, sort of like I am, or whether they're hearing it for the first time, I got to believe everybody can take something away from it, because none of us gets out of this life without some kind of pain like that. And it's heartbreaking, but it's also beautiful and inspiring. And I'm really looking forward to you taking me on some of that journey and reflecting on some of the things I've been through recently. And, you know, maybe the most interesting question that we'll tackle is, do we really have to wait for something terrible to happen to transform into this better version of ourselves? Or maybe could we do something about it now?
Yeah, that's the question that we recently landed on. I say we, and I'm remarried to an amazing partner and woman who you've known for years as well, Bob, Whitney. She and I have been wrestling with that question as a central one. And really, I think that's what my life's work has turned into. And yeah, would love to talk about that. That's a huge question.
So before we get into Allison's story, I'd love if you could take us back to before all this happened. So I don't know what that means, like Greg's life in 2018, maybe. How would you describe kind of your life and your goals, your perspective? What do we need to know about Greg before all this happened?
Greg, before all this happened, was living a perfect life. I was happily married. Allison and I met at university and steadily built our friendship and relationship for years and years and years. And what had always been my life was moving from one thing to the next naturally, whether it was high school to a great university where I got a business education to landing what was the most incredible job out of university, going to work as a consultant at a firm and getting flown around North America for build engagements when I was just this new grad, to moving into a sales job where you and I met each other in the tech industry. And things just kept clicking along one thing to the next. And I think I've heard that in other episodes that you've had with people on the show where things were just going so smoothly. We got married in 2012 and then we bought a home. We did not struggle to get pregnant, which we spent all these years trying to avoid that. And then we're very fortunate and we got pregnant right away. But we've heard story after story since then of that it's just not that easy for so many people. So we were blessed and we didn't even know how lucky we were. We had a beautiful son named William, another son named Maxwell and Madison. And we kept buying, selling homes, trading up. And then we landed in 2018, actually, in our what would be this dream home. I was living the dream. But that Talking Heads song, I think if you were to ask me kind of the internal conversation that was happening, I think I was asking a little bit, if I was really reflective on it, you know, how did I get here? Like the Talking Heads song, like, this is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife. Because it just felt a little bit like things had gone so smoothly. And I thought that I would be happy when I landed there in 2018, but it's not that I wasn't happy. It's just, I didn't feel like this was it. It felt a little bit like, really? Okay, well, what's next? I've done all the things, but it just didn't feel like I thought it should.
Yeah, you're right. That is such that's certainly how I would describe a lot of my life, even up to, you know, maybe a couple of years ago, right? It's such a common thing. And I never really spent much time thinking about whether this is something I really wanted to do. It just really did seem kind of easy, at least in retrospect.
To not be grateful for all of those things happening seems like you must be an asshole.
Yeah.
I don't think I even recognized the privilege that I had as a white male too. And I think you and I share that quality. And at the time it felt like there wasn't a spot for me to say and have an honest conversation, really, to say, so what, well, like, what's going on here? Because even with Allison, I mean, we were just in the hustle bustle of life, three young kids and under five. And so I think I've come to look at that as this idea of autopilot. You're just kind of going from day to day and doing life as best you know how. But there's something really, I think, strange about how that feeling can creep in and just live in the back of your mind. Like, what is going on here? Like, what is actually going on?
So at some point, I guess in 2019 or early 2020, all of that changes. So you can walk us through how that story starts.
So we had had William in 2015, Maxwell in 2016, and then Madison in 2018. So, this may not go over well, but a friend had joked, you know, my wife was fertile as a compost pile. I'll use that here. I mean, we were very fortunate and very blessed. And again, we didn't recognize how privileged and blessed we were, but it was true. We just had one kid after another. And so Allison was perpetually on leave, maternity leave. And come the end of 2019, she had returned to work and she was in a demanding role at an amazing nonprofit organization and was leading this community development strategy for our region. How do we take newcomers and transition them into society so that they don't go down this other path, which is a high-risk path? And so incredibly important work. And she had just pivoted so quickly from effectively stay-at-home parenting to full-time work. We were just running 150 miles an hour. And I think some distance had grown between us. So we ended 2019, came into 2020 and said, with this renewed sense of commitment, let's do this year well together. Let's do 2020 well together. Let's commit to spending time one-on-one and with each other and with each of the kids, because this time's just going to go so fast. But as you alluded to right from the start, we just never got that chance. Through January of 2020, Allison started to experience terrible headaches. And for years, she had been a bad sleeper, struggling with insomnia through just the whole time that I'd known her. And then the back to work, the strain of young kids, we thought maybe these terrible headaches were just stress. And so she would sleep a little more on the weekends, which would be terribly frustrating to me. We'd put off visits with friends just so that she would have time to rest. And by the end of the month of January, it got more concerning because her vision started to blur. And so went and saw an optometrist. We have a good family friend that's an optometrist. And they said, nope, her eyes are fine. So there's got to be something else going on. So that was a little bit disconcerting as well. And then coming into February, the family day weekend, we had a trip planned to go away together and visit her grandfather in Ottawa. And on the Friday, she woke up and the headaches were too intense for us to go. And instead of taking the kids out of school and daycare, we sent them in. She went to the hospital. They did a scan just to see if there's anything going on. They didn't find anything, but they gave her some, I think, horse tranquilizer type steroid, whatever, just to calm her head down, and booked her in for an MRI on the, what would be the Tuesday early in the morning. So Monday night, Tuesday morning. And what came from that MRI was just a few hours later getting a phone call. We got to come in and see the doctor and found out that she had a growth on the base of her brain. And likely what was causing all the pain was swelling that was happening because the tumor had grown and was blocking fluid from draining from her brain. I learned about this idea that her brains are circulating fluid all the time. I didn't really know that, but she had incredible pressure that had built up, and that's why she was experiencing headaches. That's why she was putting off the visits with friends. So I'd been frustrated for all these reasons, but she was battling a ton of pain. And we found out later that week that it was in fact cancer. It was located in a spot that they could not operate. And so this was the best she was going to be. So from there, we were just, it was a question of, well, if it's something called high grade, then we're in a situation where we're talking about weeks or months. If it's low grade, then we can treat it and we can manage it, but we will never get it out. So it will be terminal. But maybe it's 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, who knows? And over the course of the next couple of days, we had the opportunity to face that. What a punch in the face. Mm-hmm. I'm saying it kind of practically now, and I'm kind of even surprising myself. Like, you have brain cancer and you're going to die. This is as good as it's going to get for you, was the news we were given. And we both treated it quite practically. It was okay, well, how do we deal with that? Let's probably best case, a few years and we'll figure this out. But we started making plans for what would be the best case and what would be the worst case and mapping it all out.
Yeah, I've got to believe it's, I don't know. I mean, just your instinct is like, okay, here's a problem. We're going to break it down. We're going to start planning. And I guess, it's a survival mechanism and it's a way for us to feel like we're trying to take back some control over this thing that we have virtually no control over.
So getting the news and how it affected Allison right away, it just didn't seem real. It's kind of, I think with your experience with your son, like an out-of-body experience, you're seeing something happening and it's kind of, you're hovering above it. And I've heard people describe those experiences before, whether it's a personal near-death experience or just something terrible. You just sort of like float back and you're watching yourself. It didn't happen for me right away, but it certainly did for Allison. She just was shaken by that. I remember her physically shaking at that news, but it did transition really quickly to, okay, well, let's plan for the worst and hope for the best, right? So what does the next few weeks look like? What does this look like? And just mapping things out. And I got onto an email thread with who would be our key people that we would share updates with, and just very pragmatic in going along. But all of that went completely off the rails because 4 days later, when she got in for her biopsy, so they had to go into the brain, they had to take a pinprick of tissue from the tumor and assess, was this that high grade weeks or months situation or low grade? And that pinprick did two things. First, it confirmed that it was high grade, and we had weeks or months. And I remember getting that news and just falling to the floor in the hospital. And then the other impact was that she lost the mobility in her arm and legs. And so she had walked into the hospital, but now would need to be a patient. And that meant for whatever weeks or months we had left, like, well, how do we parent these young children? Sure, like, let's not even worry about getting back to work, but how do we get you into the shower, up and off, up and down from the toilet? Really simple things. And all of that just went away immediately.
How do you deal with telling the kids about this?
So at the time, William's 4, Maxwell's 2, and Madison's 1. So they saw Allison go into the hospital and didn't perceive that there was anything wrong. And then when the procedure was done, William came in to see her and had to push her in a wheelchair. And he looked at her like he didn't even know who she was. And I think that that broke her heart. It just certainly broke mine. But he just looked at her and said, "Nah, I don't know. I don't know about this. You're not who I thought you were."
Yeah.
What happened to Mom? For Maxwell and Madison, I think they saw her as she was. They saw who she was. And so they embraced her. But they're so young that for them it was, they just wanted to live their life and jump around and play. And now here was somebody who couldn't do that with them anymore. So it was kind of like seeing a grandparent sitting on the couch, like, no, what are you doing? I love my grandparent, but they're just sort of sitting there and they're not that fun. So I'm just going to go and do my thing. She became for them somebody who they loved, but they were always waiting for Mom to get back. It was for the first little while, this question of when, okay, well, Mom went to the hospital, when's she coming back? So when her journey began, COVID hit just a few weeks later, we actually had to take the kids away. So we physically had to have them live with my parents for a week. And then I would go and get my parents and take them to our cottage, which is where I am today, and spend a week with them here, then drop them back with my parents. And I would go home and spend a week with Allison through her treatment. And we would just be bouncing around because we couldn't risk the kids bringing COVID into our home. And when we finished treatment and realized that didn't work, nothing's going to work, and now it's just a matter of time, we brought the kids back to the house. And I've got a video of it on my phone that they ran into the house and they're like, oh, like they were away for 40 days and they had been living out of suitcases all over the place. And the joy that they felt of returning home was, it was like Christmas morning in May. And Madison ran into the room that we had set up for Allison before we left and went, Mom? Mom? Yeah. So I think they thought she wasn't home yet. And then when the end came, so treatment didn't work, Allison made the brave decision to just stop all treatment at the end of May because it just wasn't going to work. All it was going to do was prolong her suffering. And she said, no, I'll let nature take its course. And no more steroids, no more chemo, nothing. We took the kids to visit her when she had just a couple days left to live to say goodbye. And that experience was when they saw how sick she was. And they saw that she was not going to be okay. And for William, he said, okay, like, I it's okay that mom's got to go. And I think for Maxwell and Madison, they're still very young, 1 and 2. It's not that they understood, but I think that they saw what was happening in some way, and they said that this isn't going to be okay. And so the conversation was, mom's going to go. We said she's going to go to heaven. And what that was just a place that was not here. We're not religious. But she's going to go to this other place. But her body's going to go. But she's going to stay here with us. And so then, for them, it became like this idea of an adventure. They're like, oh, when's she going to go? When's she going to get there? What's it going to be like when she's there? And she's going to be able to walk again, and she's going to be able to talk, and all those things will be great. And for Madison and Maxwell, they're at the time not able to process it, but since then, they live with this notion that mom lives in their heart. She's always there. She's a part of it. She's a part of their lives now, every day. And for William, he wanted he was such an intuitive kid then, and still is now. He just wanted her to be safe. So for him, he was okay as long as mom was safe. So she passed just a couple of days after they said goodbye. And from that day forward, it was just like, okay, Dad, what are we doing next? What's next? What do we do now? And they were so resilient and strong and inspiring that they were able to go, okay, you know, this terrible thing has happened. And William says it now, and Madison has internalized it a bit too, and Maxwell in his own way certainly has. But William goes, that's the worst thing that's ever going to happen to me. It's not going to get any worse than that. So what do we do now? What's next, Dad? What are we doing? And the next day we went for a hike, and we got this picture of just smiles in our faces. And they were just here for it, here to keep moving forward, carry mom with them in their heart all the time. But super game for saying, okay, Dad, what's next? Where do we go from here?
Yeah, there's so much about that that's so inspiring. Like the having three kids that age and seeing how they experience that and what they take away from it differently and how resilient they are. You know, coming back to your Allison being as fertile as a compost pile, like it's almost like, you know, it's the universe's way of saying, okay, you got a short time here. We're going to give you the gift of these three kids because you know, because you're going to need them. Like, you can't do this without them.
Yeah, I think there's something to that for sure. I think that part of that question at the beginning, like, who are you in 2018? And what was life like in 2018? Like, I don't know how many people who have life going along, moving so steadily forward, how many of them go, yeah, I want 3 kids and a house here and a job here. I don't know that people have that clarity of a vision for themselves. I certainly didn't. I didn't want any number of, I don't know how many kids I wanted, right. But here I was with 3 kids. And when Allison finished her treatment and knew that the end was going to hit and there wasn't hope for her to walk again and make dinner for the kids again and do any of those things, she said, how are you going to do this? And then she asked, as best she could, because it took her a long time to say anything at that point, but who are you going to do it with? And she meant, Greg, I know you can't do this alone. And those kids are going to need you. And so I think to your point, I became, my context shifted from maybe being this passenger in my life to, okay, I got to take this thing by the horns. Allison's kind of given me this sort of question, like, how are you going to do this and who are you going to do it with? And it's up to me to figure out where I go from here. That doesn't mean I have to do it alone. And certainly through that time, even with COVID hitting and people had to retreat to their homes and to their bubbles and all that crazy shit we dealt with, there were people that just leaned in and stepped in and helped. And I lost so many friends through that time. People that through their grief couldn't understand how to reach out or help. And still to this day, I get message from time to time of, I just didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to help. And they did nothing in place of that. Or maybe they did the wrong thing because they were just trying to handle their own grief. I don't hold anything against anyone for that, but I saw who my real friends were through that time. And people who have re-entered my life now, and they're just so, like you, Bob, are so genuine in saying, like, what was that like meeting me now where I am and accepting me for who I am because I've changed into a different person. And you knew me then, but not as well. And now you and some other people kind of go, we like this new Greg. And we like this new version that you've turned into. And I think that having the kids as the anchor for what's right for them is the thing that's going to keep me going from one step to the next, is what got me through that.
So a couple of things I wanted to ask about. So you wrote a really powerful memoir about this period. I think it really only covers about, what, the 5 months between her diagnosis and her passing away and the days shortly after. It's, you know, really powerful. I haven't gone through it in detail, and it feels like something that deserves my full attention. But I did pick out a few things about it. And when you were talking about, you know, you talked about how that memoir was really important because you found like your memories were already starting to fade. And, you know, I lost my dad 30 years ago and most of my memories are gone. And I really wish I had done something like that, but it has inspired me to say, well, maybe it's not too late. Mm-hmm. And I think if I started to write them down, I would start to remember other things. But the thing is that I've realized too, is that they're not always the memories I really want to keep. Like the one that really comes to mind most is being at his bedside when he took his last breath. Like, why do I want that to be the one memory? There's so many better things to remember. I guess that's my long-winded way of asking, like, how do you keep those memories alive and keep those best moments, memories of Allison's life alive? Because especially for your kids, right? Because that seems like a huge responsibility to not let them forget.
So first of all, I don't think it's too late. And I do think that as soon as you start that journey of writing it down, talking it out, whatever it might be, not just with Allison, but with other things, you start that walk down memory. Oh, right. And then that thing happened and that thing happened. And it's not too late, absolutely, to start that journey. I think you should. I definitely think you should. But for keeping Allison's memory alive, I don't know what would be worse. I mean, for you, you lost a parent in your 20s and you had all these memories. For the kids, William has some memories. He had his fifth birthday as she was going through her treatment. For the others, they would have these little flashes of memories of her. So this narrative that we have is that you were always carrying Mom or Allison into the things we do. We talked about this idea that there's four physical beings, but there's five spiritual ones in our family. And so you, wherever we go, there's a piece of her that's a part of that. So we're creating these new memories together. But that's just one aspect of it, because your dad didn't get to meet your kids and your, perhaps not your wedding, and see you do the things you're doing now. But you can probably imagine what he might say. I suspect you could. And I think I've tried to instill that in the kids, and Whitney has as well. This idea of like, what? She'd be so proud of you now. And the people who are around us who remember Allison do that as well. The other thing, though, is just pictures. Mm-hmm. We've got a photo album of our family 1.0. And then we've created this new beautiful blended family. So it's sort of 2.0. And it's this open book in this open two parts and two different chapters of our lives that, because of the partnership that Whitney and I do have, she isn't threatened by that. She embraces that and welcomes it, because it's just so rich for the kids. And that's been a gift in and of itself, that we can embrace the past, not move on from it, but keep moving forward. Don't leave it behind. You kind of carry it with you and create new memories as you keep moving forward in life. I think it takes a lot to be okay carrying grief with you, because I think it's easier to just shut it out. But grief doesn't go away. It's kind of like this, it's like shame in a way, I think, that if you don't address that thing, it'll just fester and grow in the back. But if you can confront it and know that it won't ever go away, but have it become just a thing you recognize, oh, there's that grief wave hitting again, and you come to terms with that and just accept it, then you're much better suited to keep moving forward with it. I think two things helped me to do that. The kids, there was just no option. But also counseling. Counseling's so important. And I think, I think that I was always open to it, but I'd never done it. And then this was a reason to start. And that's something now that I do a couple times a year, even when I'm feeling good. And the kids do as well. Just to normalize it so that they always see that as a thing that they have in their lives.
Hey, it's Bob, and I'm taking the Growth Mixtape on the road in a series of keynote speeches inspired by the stories of my amazing guests. At their core, these signature talks are about how to get you and your teams off autopilot and stop settling for small incremental improvements. This isn't going to come from spewing business advice. My podcast is full of people that have done incredible things, and every one of them struggles with self-doubt, imposter syndrome, and the crippling fear of judgment that holds so many of us back. They've also found ways through it by rediscovering their creativity, their curiosity, and the confidence to do scary things. Imagine the power of bringing these vulnerable stories to life, live and on stage, to help you and your teams hit your targets, find your voice, and be the rock stars you are. Book me for your next event at bobmathers.ca. Now back to the show. So I wanted to talk about sort of the growth that's happened as a result of all of this, but you've alluded to Whitney, and she feels like an important part of this story that we haven't really introduced yet. So where does she come into the picture, and how do you integrate a new person into your life when your kids have just lost their mother?
That is a big question.
Yeah, I had a feeling it might be.
Whitney and I have known each other for years. We had this friendship that formed, and you actually introduced me to her years and years and years ago, just through professional networks and connections. And there was a friendship there. She came in and joined the team at the company I was working at. And so we actually worked together. And then through the diagnosis and then the hitting of trauma, when people didn't know what to do, well, nobody knows what to do ever, but her instinct was to lean in and support. And it was just this outpouring of love, just whatever it might be and whatever it might take to support us through that journey. So it wasn't heavy-handed. There wasn't a lot of it, but there was just this really open desire to be supportive and help. And what's interesting about that transition from one chapter of life to another was that it was COVID, and you kind of were in a bubble or not in a bubble. And there wasn't really a transition from mom to Whitney. It was sort of like an evolution to people that we're going to go on a hike with. Whitney has a son as well, and he's a young man now. He's 14, but at the time he was 8 or 9. And so, you know, it wasn't just her getting to know the kids. It's also the, you know, him getting to know me, and her ex-husband, who she's very close with, getting to know me and going, whoa, 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 whoa. Widower, young kids, you work together. This has red flags all over it. This doesn't sound like a love story from a Disney movie. Like Greg's supposed to be grieving for the rest of his life, lonely and sad. As a quick side trail here, it didn't occur to me until this happened that every fucking Disney movie ever made has the death of a parent in it. And I would put on a movie for the kids on a Saturday night, and then I go into the room and they're bawling. And I'm like, what's the matter? And mom died again. And like, oh shit, change the movie. And it's like, dad died this time. It's like, oh, dad, are you going to die? Every movie it has, and the characteristic of these films that our society and our culture is so used to is, well, then Greg's got to stay sad. And so it's not that I wasn't sad. It wasn't that I wasn't grieving. It was that there is this real reality that there's life after this, and there's a moving forward that has to happen. And there's an intentionality to what every day brings, because it put it into acute focus that you don't know if you're going to make it to 30, 40, 50, 60, wherever you are. You just, all you've got is today. And so the transition was more of a, it's not like it ended when Allison died. It ended when she was diagnosed, and there were months of process. There were months where things were being processed, and then it was like a hike, and then it was, let's spend some time together. And Whitney and Allison knew each other, and they were familiar with one another. So Allison and Whitney had this history and familiarity, and so there was a respect there that Whitney took. And to give Whitney one more shout out and bit of credit, and again, if anyone hears this and is going through loss and wants to talk about how to transition a family, Whitney could give a masterclass on this. She and her husband, ex-husband, separated when their son was 18 months old. And it was always just about him. And putting your kids at the center and taking yourself out of it is a recipe for success. And so for her, it was just always about those kids. And if us having a relationship ever impacted her son or the three kids, it was not an option. And that made things really simple.
Whitney is amazing. You're right. You alluded to sort of this new version of Greg compared to the old version. I mean, how do you describe how this has changed you?
So Allison passes away. I have a bereavement leave, a few months where I'm off work, and the company I'm with was incredible at just giving me that space and time. And I decided I'm not going back. I did not have a plan. I set up a company. I'll do a bit of consulting and just figure out where things go from here. And much to my chagrin, I didn't want it, but landed in a new job. And I was in a new job working with a company, building a business with an incredible co-founding team. And we built it, and it grew and shrunk and grew and shrunk and grew. And we did what we did with the business. But I was fearless. was the first transition. I understood what really mattered, what was scary, what wasn't scary. I think I had this different view of context of, or this different context of what my life was really about. And it was about the three kids. If they were good, then I was good. And it had never been about that before. It was really about what, how much money I was making and what title I had. But what was interesting and what fascinated me now, because I didn't immediately become this new person, it was getting into this job, buying a house with Whitney, getting married and going through the... Fast forward a few years and I was back to what I was doing before. It was fucked. It was back to this, what? How did I get here? The talking heads was back again, like playing in my head. It's not that I was unhappy, but I saw myself going into these patterns with a new beautiful wife, a new blended family, but a job and kind of feeling nervous. And I got to hit the next quarterly number. I'm like, none of this matters. And I think that's where the shift happened for me, was realizing that I had become on autopilot again, nervous again. And I thought that doesn't seem like an acceptable way to live. When Allison said, how are you going to do this? Who are you going to do this with? It was not about, you know, make sure you get a good job and have a nice house. It was about, don't forget how precious life is. It was about something different. And so who I've become, I think it's, if there's one or two words that were to summarize who I've turned into now, I reflect on the resilience that I didn't know that I had. And I hadn't really been, life had been pretty easy as we talked about, but I became focused on the fact that resilience is the number one thing that we need to instill in our kids. And it's the number one thing we as a society need to develop. Because it's not a characteristic, like you are resilient or you're not. You don't know when a bad thing's going to happen. And when that bad thing happens, you will go through the ringer and be tested. And there's a skill there that you can develop over time or not. You can let it flounder. You and I were talking before this Boyd Vardy quote, the most dangerous thing about modern life is there is no danger. And we've become complacent and slow and sluggish and we don't grow. So resilience would be one word. The second is intentionality. Just being intentional about, like, is this the job that I want? I'm in a privileged position to some degree, but I do not have millions of dollars in the bank. And I can't live on the interest. I have to have a job. The kids need to go to school. We have choices that we have to make. But when you strip it all back, it's amazing how much choice you really have. But I think people get stuck on this notion of, I'm making $200,000 a year now. Well, I need to live a $250,000 lifestyle, and then I need to get a job so I can afford that, and then I'm living a $350,000 lifestyle, and so it goes. And it's just because we're trying to impress others, or we're trying to put on a show for ourselves, chasing a thing that we'll never get to. I think too few people get off this idea of autopilot and onto an intentional life. And the new version of Greg, I think, focuses on, okay, how am I building resilience? So doing hard things. And showing that and teaching that to my children, because I'm a stepdad now and I take that responsibility incredibly seriously, because it's not just my three who are amazing. These are four amazing kids. So how do we teach them that? And how can we show what it means to be intentional and how you live your life?
Yeah, that's interesting when you were talking about going back and how close you were to your life snapping back to its original shape, right? You know, this saying that, you know, God never gives you anything you can't handle. I'm not a particularly religious person either, but what I take away from that quote is that we are capable of so much more than we believe. And we will never know what we're capable of until, like you simply had no choice, which begs the question, is it possible for people that are in that comfort zone to almost manufacture some sort of sense of urgency to transform themselves without waiting for that trauma? Because that trauma is coming in some form or another, like you said. And you can either be proactive about it, or you can just wait for it to happen and then be like, yeah, I got to change my life. I've got so many days left and I want to do something more with it.
You're hitting on something that's deeply important. I think it kind of brings us from that experience to what I think my life is about now. There's a concept, and it's a psychological concept called post-traumatic growth. We all know about post-traumatic stress. Post-traumatic stress is a thing that people experience, and I have a ton of empathy for that. But there's this other concept called post-traumatic growth. People can go through a traumatic experience and experience growth, and they built a model about around post-traumatic growth, which I'm deeply focused on. And it's these five areas of: you become personally stronger, you develop closer relationships, you have a greater appreciation for life around you, you see new possibilities around you, and there's some form of spiritual development. I can say from my experience that all five of those things have happened for me. And so to your question, can you create or manufacture an experience without waiting for the trauma? I believe you can. And I believe you should. Because as tough as the experience is that William, Madison, and Maxwell went through in losing their mom, they're going to have other hard shit. And it's not that they'll forget that experience, but they're going to be scared of losing a friendship or a relationship at some point in the future. And they won't go, well, you know, losing relationships is hard, but I've been through that before. They'll be stuck just the way we all get stuck. So I think the number one thing is figuring out a way to be intentional about how you live and asking yourself the question, am I truly satisfied with the life that I have today? Or is there something that I'd like to change? And I think if we're honest with ourselves, most of us are happy to just stay on autopilot and we're afraid to ask ourselves that question. So I think you can, but it does require somebody being willing to ask themselves that question with, which is, how intentional am I being about my life? And I think it's my life's work to figure out how to get more people to ask themselves that question.
What do you think is the hardest part of people coming to that point and asking themselves that question?
I think that like 2018 Greg wanted other people to be impressed with the life that I had. That included in-laws, my own parents, and friends and community around me. And I think it's a thing that we're terrified of. I think inherently terrified of, to think about what does that actually look like for me? Is this the person that I want to be married to? Or am I just married to this person? Is this the house that I want to live in? Or is it just the house that I'm living in? Same thing with the job, same thing with the kids. And I think it's terrifying to confront the reality that you're going to die. Life is terminal. It's going to come to an end at some point. And I think we're so used culturally to just having things be other people's responsibility, life really is your responsibility. We're not going to get through it unscathed. And when a bad thing happens, you're going to get forced to answer that question. You're better to just do that on your own terms than wait.
Yeah, it does remind me of a guest we had on a while ago. She was a hospice nurse, and she wrote a book called 7 Lessons for the Living from the Dying, or something like that. And, you know, this idea of regret, like, how do we listen to the stories of people that have gotten to the end of their lives and looked back and said, I wish I had spent more time, you know, with my kids. Nobody ever, you know, the only people that will ever remember how much you worked are your kids, right? So that idea that is coming, like, you know, these are people that have watched thousands of people die, and they have seen over and over again, these are the experiences of people that get to the end of their lives and look back and wish they had done something different. So it's happening. Like, don't.
It's happening.
You have a chance right now to do something differently with it. And one of the things when you were talking, Greg, I've thought about is, you know, I've talked about the diagnosis with Will a little over a year ago, and he's fully recovered and it was amazing, but I've talked quite a bit on the podcast about it. And so I can say Jill and I have made some changes. We're definitely try to be more present and intentional. And so I do feel good about that. But I also ask myself, if something even more terrible were to happen tomorrow, would I really look back on my life today and say, yes, I'm doing all I can? I have a feeling that I would say, no, I made some changes, but I was still on autopilot. I think there's a lot more I could be doing. And the question is, why am I not doing it?
I think you've got to give yourself a little bit of credit too. And we have to give ourselves some grace. As somebody who's known you for a long time, there has been a lot of transformation and growth. This podcast is something that's impacting people. But I think that there's the thing. I think that you're aware of the journey that you're on, and that sense that I'm not quite there yet is, I think, the exact feeling that people need to get comfortable with, as opposed to trying to convince ourselves that we've arrived. Because when we convince ourselves, try to convince ourselves that we've arrived, the reality is we know we're lying to ourselves. We still try to do it anyway. And so to think of yourself as, oh, I've still got this other thing I want to do, I think you're on the right track and you're on the right path. And I would encourage you just to keep going.
I appreciate that. I also think it does come back to, and I want to talk about Vienna Waits, because all of this kind of culminates in, you mentioned kind of finding your purpose or the current flavor of it, and how that's prompted you to start this organization to help people to live more intentionally. I'll let you describe it. Tell me about a bit about Vienna Waits.
Vienna Waits started as an idea that maybe we would produce some content around this idea of being more intentional about how we live, but it turned quickly into a conversation about content isn't enough, because there's tons of content. Content isn't the problem. Action is the problem. And so Vienna Waits was co-founded by Whitney and I, and it started as this content concept, but shifted quickly into this idea that we need to help people take action to be more intentional in how they live. And so the way we started doing that was through a program, and it's called Unblock Yourself. And it's this notion of bringing forward a thing that you've been wanting to do, but you've been putting off, whether it's a little side hustle or a career change you want to make, and building the plan like you would at work, and putting yourself in action to move toward it. And it's been remarkable to see how that's impacted every single person we've had go through that program beginning in January. And thank you, Bob, for being part of that journey and kind of continuing on that path with us too. People are transformed by action. And I think we get stuck on autopilot because we get confused with how to act. We have different conflicting messages about what our purpose might be. And once I figure out my purpose, then I'll take action. Action will help you find that purpose. And if you can ever even find what purpose is for you, I think that's an elusive idea, and it can change from one year to the next of what my purpose might be. But pursuing it is what it's really all about. And so this program, Unblock Yourself, is our first. And then we have a retreat that we're running, which is focused on helping people to pause. So take stock of what's happening in their lives, prioritize all the things that are most important to them, and then build a plan to pursue it and go after it, similar to that unblock process. And our mission is to reach 1 million people, help them to be more intentional in how they live. And one way or another, whether it's through conversations like this, through programming, or these retreats that we intend to run, we want to get to that 1 million people and make this idea of living intentionally something that is accepted and understood, as opposed to the exception that just a handful of people seem to get after. And it's, I think it's all rooted in this idea of helping people to achieve post-traumatic growth without the trauma. Don't wait for that bad thing to happen to you. Let's put these practices in place to get moving toward the best possible life you can live, because it is terminal. Something's coming for you at some point or another, so you may as well get after it.
I love that. And one of the things I've talked to you and Whitney about this, about that unblocked cohort that we went through, the inaugural one, you know, I went into it, I didn't really know what to expect. I've done kind of a self-help kind of cohort thing like that. It was during COVID. I never really finished it. And yes, the program is great. There are some great tools and tricks, but man, the thing that I really took away from it was hearing the stories and the connections with the 9 other people in that group. And these are really successful people that showed up and willing to talk about their insecurities and their imposter syndrome, and they were vulnerable. And it felt a bit like therapy, but we all just came away with such a better understanding of each other and ourselves and not feeling so alone. But it was, I really took a lot away from that. It was amazing.
Well, thank you. I think each person contributes to that space. We're proud to say that they did get recreated in another group. We have another group starting later this week, actually. And it's really more than anything about meeting people where they're at and getting people comfortable with sharing their stories. Because I think this conversation, sharing a bit of my story, I haven't done it authentically. A, maybe I haven't been ready to share, but also B, I just have this sense that, well, who wants to hear my story? And it turns out that by stepping in and sharing, and I think it was Whitney who shared her story a little bit at the beginning of our group, that's what people need, is authenticity. What is, mm-hmm. what is this really about? I'm not doing this to make millions of dollars and buy a yacht. I'm doing this because I fundamentally believe that everyone has the power to change the trajectory of their lives. And the reason I believe that is because it happened to me. And I'm just so deeply passionate about helping people to make that change happen for themselves instead of waiting for it to happen to them. But that all sounds well and good until you understand the story. And I think everyone has a story like that. Why are you here, Bob? Why do you want to get unblocked? All those people have a story. And once you understand that, it gets so much clearer how we can all do incredible things in our lives to show up for one another.
Well, I love that, Greg. I've got one last question before that, kind of a reflection. So it's interesting. When I look back on, you and I met maybe 10 years or so ago. We were working together on a big client at a tech company. You know, we went our separate ways and we stayed connected. And I was always a little bit jealous of the path that you were on. You worked at this amazing company with this amazing leader and you built this amazing team. And I guess it was 2020, a mutual friend of ours was trying to put together a panel of CS experts. And so we were going to be on this panel together. And then I got a note from her saying, oh, the panel's off. Greg can't make it. And I was like, they wouldn't have never have canceled this panel if I couldn't make it. Like, oh, Greg, the delicate genius, can't make it. So, you know, so this whole thing was off and I was kind of pissed off about it. And then I reached out to her and said, well, something's going on with Greg and you should reach out. And of course, I found out a little bit about what was going on and felt pretty bad about that. But, you know, when you talk about your, you know, the friends that showed up for you and the ones that didn't, I definitely was in that camp. Like, I didn't know what to say. It was, you know, I wish I had done more, but I can't tell you how grateful I am that we've kind of come back together. And I think we've both changed. I don't think the old Greg would have liked the new Bob, and the new Bob might not have, you know, gotten away or whatever, you know, vice versa. But it's, I'm just so incredibly grateful for coming back together. And this conversation has just been one I will never forget.
Bob, thank you for, I actually think, I think I remember this panel. I think I didn't know where you were going with that. Bob, thank you. And I think that it's never too late to, whether it's reminding yourself some of those stories about your dad or to rebuild those relationships. I think new Greg and new Bob are going to get along just fine.
I think you're right. I love that. So one last question. It's my new favorite question I stole from Tim Ferriss, who I think you're a fan of as well. Mm-hmm. The billboard question. If you had a giant billboard that a million people would see, you could put anything on it, a picture, a meme, a quote, whatever it could be, and you could put it out to the world, what would yours say?
So I was back and forth on this one, but I think it comes down to this. It's, what the fuck are you waiting for? I think it's punchy. I think people would see that and go, what is this an ad for right now? But I think I would want that for myself. I would want to see that every day. And I think it would be the thing that would have people go, oh, what am I waiting for? And it would force it to the front of their minds, that thing that we're carrying around that we're just not doing. You're going to die. So what the fuck are you waiting for? That's what I would want to put up there.
I think that's a mic drop. I can't think of a better way to end this conversation. And honestly, the hardest part of the post-production part of this podcast is coming up with a title for every episode that's kind of punchy and draws people in. What the fuck are you waiting for? Is perfect. I can't wait to put this out and with that title.
Bob, I can't wait to share it, listen to it back, and continue to just listen to each episode that you do. I love who you're bringing onto the show. I'm very humbled that I get to be a part of it, and I just look forward to being part of New Bob's future.
Thank you so much, Greg, for this. I can't thank you enough.
This has been great. Thanks, Bob.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.